legitimately, on one side of their, with one half of their minds, thinking, be nice to get some money out of this thing, because I was supposed to get some money and then I never did. And whether it's Congress that's responsible or the guys running the corporations who didn't earn the profits that they were supposed to and so didn't pay the dividends and I didn't get any money, there's that feeling. And yet, I think the dominant feeling, even among those people who feel that sense of grievance, that I should have got something out of this, and maybe in 1991 I will, if you say to them, and this is the discussion that's gone on at the village hearings that I've held, other Native people have said, but if you sell your shares, then outsiders will come in, they'll own this land, it won't be ours anymore. Surely you wouldn't sell your shares then. They say, okay, I wouldn't sell my shares, now when you put it that way. And yet, again and again, people say, I don't think I should sell my shares, I think it'd be a bad thing if we all sold, and yet, faced with a temptation, I might do that. And of course, all of us in life can agree on some abstract principle that we shouldn't do such and such, and yet in certain circumstances we might find that as individuals we would do that very thing. And so Congress has set up this dilemma, and it's something that nobody else has really faced in quite this form. Now I've got all these experts here, the attorneys, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but I don't think anybody's ever had to wrestle with anything quite like this. And
I'd like to just address it in one way, although even though I'm an attorney, I'm not adequate to deal with this question, and that is the extent to which it is a correct view that you've expressed as to what Congress had in mind after 1991, what would happen as the nature of the corporation evolved. I think that there are a lot of corporations in American society that are basically either closely held or family nature corporations or have other qualities, even though they may have aspects of wide ownership, even public ownership, where resolutions have had to be developed that preserve cultural integrity and yet allow some economic investment from the outside. Let me just point to a couple. One is the Getty Getty family and the planning of its assets and the culmination in the Getty Foundation and the Getty Museum. Right now, recently the Getty Foundation sold the stock that it owned in the Getty Corporation, but it basically controlled the Getty Corporation, the assets of the Getty Corporation, but it used its control to further what it perceived to be the goals of Getty individually and culturally in terms of a small piece of what they wanted to do. This is true.
Excuse me, what were the cultural goals of the Gettys? Just I can't help.
Well, Getty himself had certain personal cultural aggrandizing goals, which he basically, in some totally monomaniacal way, did achieve. And the thing that's interesting to me, and the only part that's interesting for our purposes, is that the Getty Corporation was set up to involve public investors, be listed on the New York Stock Exchange, and yet repose a considerable amount of control in the Getty Trust. When the merger took place between Getty and whomever it took, whatever oil company ultimately acquired the Getty Corporation, it was the Getty Foundation that was the critical point of decision as to what that future should be. And the Getty Foundation was a nonprofit foundation that was dedicated to purposes other than maximizing the value of the Getty Corporation assets. One can think of this with respect to the Rockefellers, with respect to other family entities in this country who have tried to work out a relationship between wealth maximization and control of assets, bringing in outside investors, and a variety of other kinds of things. The only thing, I guess, the And I guess the last tidbit along these lines that I want to mention is that the Hershey Corporation, for example, is the stock, control of stock in the Hershey Corporation, or control of a large portion of the stock in the Hershey Corporation, is held by a school in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Which is the repository of some goals other than those of the board of directors of the profit-making entity. All I'm saying, I suppose, is this, that in thinking through what a corporation can be, I think it's wrong to have a simple and narrow idea of what that corporation can be. And I'm worried from your expressing it that that's basically where this entity is going. Let's say, when one thinks of the corporate alternative, is there a way of reposing control, of having preferred stock and common stock, of having stock in voting trusts, in creating entities that meet Bart's goals, that have maintained control of the corporation in ways that are moderately consistent with 1991. That is to say, this would involve some changes, may not involve any changes. I can't speak to that at this point. But address those questions without making it this polarized distinction. Because I think one of the dangers is, and I think Bart was right on this, and I hope the commission hears him on this, and that is that it's not necessary to polarize, to see these as all or nothing choices. As you stated it, it seemed to me you were saying there do seem to be these two views, and the one that is adopted in 1971 is so atypical and so far to one side that it itself is polarizing. That may not be the case. And that is to say, it may have its own adaptability, the same way the tribal form has had some adaptability, so that you can find a structure or the opportunity for a structure that meets the various goals. It seems to me, if that's true, which I'm reserving judgment on as well, the important question is, how do you allow people to make the choices? How do you provide that they're adequately informed, that they see the alternatives, et cetera? So that seems to me to be a very important function of this commission. And it wouldn't be well served by saying that the corporate structure leads only in one direction if it doesn't. It may, and I myself am not sure. And the fact that it exists, and then in its toughest outcome can lead to external control, may mean that it should be abolished as an option. But my view is that it can be adapted.
Elizabeth Johnson.
Certainly, Monroe, I would agree with you that the corporate form is very adaptable. But like Drew, I'm somewhat concerned about the depth of the Native leadership to do all of this. And by that, I do not mean that there are not Native leaders with a full complement of all the skills needed in our society, both the financial and political. I mean the numbers of the Natives' leaders when compared with the numbers of entities we're dealing with. I work for a regional corporation, and I think at the regional corporation level, there are a tremendous amount of skills in a tremendous range. But it does concern me, and maybe it is the same way Drew is seeing it, that we've pulled from many of the village corporations some of the leadership that they could have been using. And as in-house, we've tried to examine some of the corporate alternatives, particularly looking at some of the traditional anti-takeover devices, some of them that might be successful or effective in the usual corporate world. And then I try with my mind to apply what would happen with a village corporation trying to implement them. I give up, which is one of the reasons I would be very supportive of a strong restricted stock option, because I believe that the anti-takeover devices are a backup to that, not a substitution for it. And one of the reasons I believe that is not only because of what you see on Wall Street and whether anti-takeover devices are generally effective, but also this whole level of sophistication, tremendous sophistication, that I think Bristol Bay would be hard-pressed itself to implement. And when you think of the Village Corporation level doing it, it just boggles my mind at trying. So I think there is a problem with how many skilled native leaders you can expect a population of, initially it started at 70,000 and now has increased, but to be producing for something that involves, over 200 entities. I do think that remains a problem.
I'd like to ask Bart a question. You don't mind me?
No, I'd
like to ask Bart, and this goes to Elizabeth's point, and that is, in the initial formulation of the Settlement Act, there was to be a social and development corporation, a statewide nature, that was ultimately not included. I always thought that might have been a mistake. It may have been a bargain form question, where there would be some entity that had greater responsibility for relating to village corporations. It was a different model. It really goes back to the for-profit, not-for-profit question. But if you had a model of strong regional corporations that were profit-oriented or quasi and qualifiedly profit-oriented, then you had a number of village corporations that were nonprofit with a central entity that had some resources, some money, some power, some ability to hire expertise, et cetera, that might have been provided better results, and perhaps that could be considered in the 1991 planning. So if this is a question of providing assistance to village corporations, maybe you'd like to comment on the history of that, which I think has not been very good.
So you want to know a little bit about what were the components of, at the end result, is there any possibility of getting an overall kind of assistance to villages? First of all, in regards to the statewide social services group, there were too many issues banged into one little thing there. There were a number of different reasons for having a statewide corporation, which varied from the federal government would ultimately end its responsibilities for giving social services, and that the intent was to use settlement funds to provide social services. That was one reason for rejection. The regional corporations and the voluntary associations who were going in didn't think it was feasible, because at one point this wouldn't simply be a social services entity that assisted people, but other statewide corporations had for their purpose managing the finances side, I mean actually being the business entity. The various voluntary associations didn't like the idea of centralized power where they'd already set up a statewide regional kind of power system. So the assistance aspect for villages was not really centered at that point. And the only other rationale that there was at one point was that this corporation may have ultimately become AFN, and that way it would have been able to been funded by settlement funds and have been a powerful political power. The state opposed that. So there were various reasons why a large statewide corporation was defeated. Now, that doesn't say that there haven't been efforts to assist village corporations. I mean, ANF, the Alaska Native Foundation, for the longest time and to this day still has that as one of its purposes. Groups like Glenn, by merging, have been able to provide their own kind of centralized leadership so that they reduce the management expenses and distribute what skills they have over a larger area. That's done in other areas also. So there are many of these, I guess most of them are nonprofits like IVA, who have centralized management that you can contract for. So I mean, it's being done on their own. And there is the possibility for that. But even so, they don't have independent sources of money, and they're still going to have to charge for the services. So the volume of activity that has to occur to protect yourself under these kind of shark repellent things and the kind of political movement that has to come about to implement them is just enormous. So, I mean, that's one thing that sways against this idea of keeping the individual being able to determine what happens versus are there some structural problems as far as the laws go that make it just too big a problem to try to have an effective, a real plebiscite that really, you know, where people really have an intelligent choice to make, and are they capable of making it? It's a problem because of just the volume of things that have to be done to protect yourself under the kind of pure corporate system that we have. Now, Tom, there's a number of things I'm kind of holding back that have to do with other things. I'd like to make sure, you know, we've got 3 days, and yeah. So I don't have to spill all my beans today.
Okay,
I have something to talk about tomorrow.
Yeah. Claude Dementiev and then Ralph Johnson. And
with all the discussion, I also have a number of questions keep popping up, and then it goes on to another topic, and it's hard to keep following it here. So I'd like to back up just a little bit to the concept of the settlement in 1991 itself. It's a special relationship, I think, that the Native people have with the federal government. The Settlement Act in word has been defined in terms of the purpose and the intent. But Congress never really defined settlement, what that word means right there. Is the settlement over? Or is this a continually agreeable situation that goes on throughout the life of the relationship, which means forever and ever with Native people and the federal government? I appreciate the analogy you made with Getty and Hershey on how corporate matters work, but I don't recall them having any settlement with the federal government, which makes Native people much more different than the Getty family. What we should probably do before 1991 is ask Congress, what is their definition of the settlement? Is the 1991 concept a periodic review that is healthy for all Native corporations to go through eventually, to continue the refinement of the settlement? Because I think most Native people do not believe that the settlement is final at this time, but it's a continuous process because of the continuing relationship that Native people must keep with the federal government.
Ralph Johnson.
I might comment a couple things about, well, first, I thought it was very interesting and very thoughtful of Bart Garber to discuss the impact of the 100-year time period of grace rather than the 20-year period. That's a very interesting elucidation of that issue. I'd like, though, to comment on Monroe Price's remarks about corporate flexibility, and I have no doubt but what the corporate structure has that flexibility and could be used for the whole range of purposes that might be available. I think there are some other facets, though, one of which is mentioned by Elizabeth Johnston, and that is the skills that are available to small communities, whether Native or non-Native, of a few hundred or a few thousand people. There just isn't going to be the kind of skill ongoing all the time to understand and implement the wide range of corporate possibilities. There's another fundamental issue that has been mentioned, and that is the question of permanence. Corporate structures come and they go, they change. You get into that thicket, and if you're skilled, and if you are a J. Paul Getty or a nation within a nation as Getty is, or as the Rockefellers are, then you have the continuing power, political and economic power, to do what you want to do and to structure the corporate form to accomplish those social, cultural, and political goals. But it's a very different thing, it seems to me, with corporations of the level that we would be talking about in Alaska. I think also there is a sense among, at least if I can identify what Vine Deloria does in his last book, the traditionalist view, which is one strong view in Alaska, and that is there should be something more permanent than a corporate form, then the question may be who should decide what the future is. Should it be the stockholders or should it be Congress? And Tom Berger has alluded to this before, but the question may be that if Congress decides that, for example, at the extreme end by putting land into a trust status, then it is not in the corporate thicket. It is not as flexible. It loses the aspect of flexibility, but it does acquire an element of permanence. It doesn't mean it's totally permanent, because Congress can also change its mind at some future time, but there is a degree of permanence that is probably not there with the corporate form.
Rosita Worrell?
Yes, I think there have been a number of different issues that we could spend the next 3 days discussing, but I'd like to just bring it back to, at least from my perspective, I'd like to note what I see as the basic elements which characterize or which are prominent in Alaska Native societies, which maintain and support a communal state or a tribe. And I think we've based most of our discussion on land, and then also resources. But also supporting this communal state or tribe, we also have ideologies and values which promote an integration or a unification of the group. And some of those kind of values are sharing of resources, redistribution of the resources among the group to take care of all of the group, the elderly, the young children. We have in place in Alaska those kind of cultural values that, you know, integrate the group. In addition to that, we also have structural organizations, and structural organizations centered around kinship systems or extended families. In the northern areas, it's the bilateral extended family. In the southeast, it's clans. Just those are three prominent elements that lead to this tribal state. I have always labeled ANCSA as a cultural encounter. A cultural encounter that brought the two conflicting ideological systems into contact. To answer a little just briefly Monroe's questions about the discontinuity and continuity, in my opinion, right at this particular point in time, we haven't felt the full impact of corporations in the villages. And I think we're, because of the delays in settlement, you know, people, the corporations not getting their land in a timely fashion or until recently, I don't think we've really felt the impact. From my perspective, and also reviewing most of the anthropological literature that's been written on Alaska Natives, I think the thing that is really remarkable is the persistence of Alaska Native groups. And in fact, I think there was a whole group of anthropologists who, within the last decade, have had to try to break down the myth that Alaska Natives were totally assimilated, and have had to demonstrate to policymakers that indeed Alaska Natives were utilizing the land in traditional forms. And I think that's where we had to deal with where subsistence became a primary issue, and that was, you know, to try to prove to policymakers and the public that Native people were not assimilated, that they were still very much involved in a traditional lifestyles. In my opinion, the cultural encounter that I see between ANCSA and Native lifestyles is yet to occur. I think we're in the process of it. And whether corporations have that kind of flexibility to protect those basic elements that I see at this point in time, I don't know. But at this point in time, I do see a viability, a persistence of Native cultures.
Yes, Roland Shanks.
Yeah, well, I've been listening, and people have been coming up with a lot of interesting ideas, and I guess I'd like to kind of throw some of my ideas and perceptions into the pot that we're going to boil over the next 3 days. I think there's something that goes even beyond the village corporation ANCSA problems that really kind of sets the framework that surrounds that problem. In Alaska, I think we're not only at a turning point as far as whether village corporations and ANCSA is going to live or change, I think we're also at a point where we need to look at the entire issue of Village Alaska, essentially. Is Village Alaska going to survive, or is Alaska going to radically change into larger urban areas with essentially the villages being depopulated and ceasing to exist? And I think that that is really at the heart of some of the concerns that we hear coming out of particularly the smaller villages when it comes to dealing with their corporations. We have villages that are not only being impacted by the economic corporate structure of ANCSA, they're also being asked to deal with municipal corporations in terms of forming first or second class cities. They're being asked to deal with the possible formation of boroughs and all that may mean as far as taxation and establishing a form of government that is that falls within the purview of the state government. We're asking them to deal with a changing educational system, which is putting schools into their villages and asking people to serve on school boards, which is something that's pretty alien out there. And when we start talking about the depth of leadership in villages, we're not talking about just the depth of leadership, which has to cover the ANCSA corporation in the village. We're talking about somebody who also has to be the mayor and the city council, who has to run the school board and maybe run the school. And we're talking about trying to establish all of these forms of rather alien structures in villages which, in many cases, have almost no economic structure at all and almost no economic potential at all. The typical small village out in the bush has very few economic opportunities. And if somebody is being civic-minded enough to sit on the school board and maybe be on the city council and also maybe be on the board of directors of his corporation, that person, there's just not enough time left over to hold down a economic position that allows that person to essentially stay alive and meet the bills. So we have a problem, I see, that we're essentially asking people to fill a role that leaves them no time for the other roles that they've filled in the past. I think that when we look at village corporations, while some village corporations are doing well, there are several village corporations that I'm sure a lot of us haven't heard from in a long time. I mean, they seem to be kind of settling into two classes. There are those that are moving along, and there are those that we just don't hear from anymore. And I think that most of the regions, at least ways know of villages within their regions that it's very hard to get answers back from, because you go out there and you'll find most of the correspondence in a blazo box in somebody's house, because he's gone down and picked it up. So we have that problem, and that is, I'm afraid that we have villages that are withering on the vine and kind of dropping off, and some of us, I don't think, are even noticing.
Corporations, you mean?
Corporations who are technically in default. I mean, we've passed one law in this state which reinstated the villages that were involuntarily dissolved. I think it's yet to be decided whether we're going to have to pass a law like that every 2 years to put villages back into status or not. So I'm very concerned that we're so busy looking at 1991 and what may happen in 1991 that we may not be mining the store now, and we may get to 1991 and discover we've already made some significant losses. I think there was some allusions earlier to the fact that I think corporations are moving into being able to better manage themselves, moving into making essentially leadership decisions based on managerial skills versus political skills. And I think that is true in lots of areas, but I think there's other areas where that may not be quite as true. I think the Alaska Native Corporation has a really strange situation, because unlike major corporations in the United States, who generally have at least ways a majority shareholder or several blocks which make up a majority shareholder, you have an interesting situation in Alaska Native corporations in that everybody starts out even. You have no majority shareholder, you have no owner and starter of the corporation who essentially took the corporation public. You have no group that took the corporation public. You have untold numbers of people coming together, all receiving an equal status in the corporation, and oftentimes with very, very radically different ideas of where that corporation should go, everywhere from the person who has very corporate types of goals to some of the people who have very traditional types of goals. And so what you've built in is a volatility in the angst of corporations that I don't think exist in most other corporations. And because of this difference in values that you see represented, the volatility is not in whether this group should manage or whether that group should manage. Oftentimes the volatility is whether there should be management or whether the land should be, or whether the corporation should go in a more traditional path. The difference is not a style of management. The difference may be what a complete different thrust in the corporations. And you have corporations that essentially get down a very crooked path because under one management, they kind of go one direction. Under the next management, all of a sudden, they're radically going in another direction there, and there's very little continuity. And to speak to the issue that Charlie brought up very early, and that is individual expectations. I think that there have been a lot of expectations built up in the Native population as to what the Settlement Act is going to provide them. And I think that in most parts, it's the failure to reach those expectations that is the source of the unhappiness. I'm not exactly who started the rumor in rural Alaska that every Native shareholder was going to automatically be wealthy and was going to have a large estate. But that's kind of the word that's gotten out. And because corporations have not been able to reach that goal, they've been looked down on. I think oftentimes corporations that are doing very well from kind of an outside perspective are viewed from inside as not meeting those expectations, therefore not doing well. Again, I think that this whole problem of each person within the corporation having a different set of values and basing their expectation on those values makes the corporation a very hard animal to deal with, because it has to be so broad to try and meet all of those different expectations. We also run into a problem of essentially Anglo-Saxon law when it comes to individual expectations, and that is there's been a lot of talk about kind of, well, we're going to transfer this corporation that way and we're going to transfer this corporation that way, and all of a sudden you run into individual rights and you end up with the fact that rights cannot be taken without compensation, and are we talking about some type of inverse condemnation for people who do not agree, and how are those issues going to be dealt with? It's essentially Congress can give, but when Congress takes away, all of a sudden Congress has to pay. That's kind of the way the rules have always gone, and those are going to be very difficult hurdles to get over. I don't have enough background and don't pretend to have enough background in corporate law to know all the ins and outs, and I sure hope that we can find some flexibility that will deal with some of the problems that we're seeing. I think some of the large family trusts, while they provide interesting ideas, have never had to quite deal with this broad disparity in what their expectations are. I mean, we saw a little bit of that in the Getty takeover, and that is that one brother went one way and one brother went the other way, and it ended up being a big fight. But the difference in that was that they were both fighting as corporate giants. They were not fighting because they had a different view of where that corporation should go. They just merely had a different view of how it should get there. And I think that it is very different. And I think that if we look at some of these large family corporations, we see corporations where, yes, they have gone public, and yes, they do have many shareholders, but again, you have that large block of family stock that gives direction and continuity to the company. And I don't think that we see that in Angsa corporations because of the fact that the shares were scattered equally over the families. So I guess I don't really have answers. I only have questions. And I think hopefully over the next few days we'll be able to address some of these. But I think it's without doubt one of the more interesting and challenging questions that have come along in a long time. And the Alaska Natives stand, I think, on the edge of some very difficult decisions, and probably even a more difficult road to implement those decisions once they've been made.
Thanks, Roland. Gary Anders.
So many good points have been made that I find myself nodding in approval with different points of view as they've been presented. I have a direction that I'd like to move toward that I think will add some substance to the discussions as we move along. With regard to values, interesting paper I read not long ago talked about implicit values in technologies, and if you look at corporations and see them as a form of technology, you can begin to appreciate what the demands that are placed upon corporations by the governments and by the shareholders, that there are relationships that have to be established, and within those relationships there are implicit structural arrangements based upon value systems. Thinking of an analogy that was made by an architect of overpasses to fairly affluent communities in the East, who specifically designed them in such a way that no public bus could pass through, only individual cars. And I guess you can either raise the overpass or, you know, come up with a different form of public transportation. I think that with regard to ANGSCA specifically, the context, the 20-year time period, the time at which it was implemented and the time that we're addressing, have to be taken into consideration. Context with regard to national policy, with regard to the political associations within the Congress, with regard to the national ideologies of the time, and also in terms of state developments. We're talking about the depletion of oil reserves and what that might bring to bear in terms of the state. And I think that that's a factor that has to be taken into consideration. What I'm hoping to contribute here is basically an attempt to define what success is. I agree that with Charlie Johnson's point that Native people have risen to a challenge in looking over the very complex legislation that gave rise to all the corporations in the state. It's not clear that there were plans made and contingencies drawn up. As a matter of fact, it's very confusing because there's just so many different agendas that are being executed. Congress didn't define what success was, and they didn't really lay out a very clear strategy for achieving certain kinds of goals. Native corporations and Native leaders have helped to elucidate those goals and to gain popular support for them. My question to the panel is, assuming that people will always find reason to disagree with each other and to in promoting their own self-interest or promoting collective interest, choose different courses of action with regard to the transfer of stock, with regard to the ownership of the corporation, with regard to the development policies that the corporation is going to try. What is at this point, given all the information that we've absorbed in the background of the discussions, what is an acceptable level of success? I mean, what are the kinds of specific objectives that we can discuss with regard to Native participation in the state's economic development? Past experience has shown that there's never been total integration of any indigenous group. And within the state of Alaska, looking down the road after the corporations have had an opportunity to work through many different problems, we're going to find ourselves constantly reevaluating different choices, different directions. But at this point, is it safe to say that a portion of the people are going to be inclined to sell their stock, that a portion of the village corporations are not going to succeed, and perhaps a portion of the regional corporations are not going to succeed? And with that understanding in mind, the question that I would submit is, how are we going to define success? And with that understanding in mind, what kinds of recommendations can be made to assure a higher probability of success in those terms?
Thank you, Gary. Maybe I could just summarize the point that we've reached at this stage, it seems to me that we start off with what Bart said, that is that there's an inner conflict that Native people feel and that has been expressed. They felt that there should have been benefits to each of them as individuals from the settlement, and in many places those expectations of individual benefit have not been fulfilled. At the same time, because the one thing you get out of the settlement is shares, the way to realize that expectation of individual benefit, assuming the shares are substantial value, the only way to realize that benefit is to cash in your shares, to sell them in 1991, and that of course places in jeopardy the native land itself. It may be lost to native people. So that's the point I was trying to make earlier, that Congress has built in this dilemma for native people, and it's something that no other group has had to face in quite this form. Now, it seems to me that's one thing. Then there's the question that Monroe Price raised. Well, let's not write off the corporation. It can do a lot of different things. It can pursue cultural values as well as profits. And I have no doubt that's true, not only for the Gettys, but for some of these native corporations. We held hearings in the Nana region last week, and that's a for-profit regional corporation that has a big museum in Kotzebue that certainly is intended to preserve native culture, at least to give it an important presence in that community, and that's an impressive testimony to the fact that for-profit corporations aren't limited simply to profit-making activities. But I think many of you would be inclined to agree that what Nana has done there is perhaps exceptional. I haven't seen many village corporations in a position to pursue cultural activities. As Roland says, many of them don't seem to be in a position to pursue for-profit activities. The settlement said to Native people in Alaska, you will now have 44 million acres of land. Well, it seems to me that really what Native people are faced with is the question, how can we hang on to what we got? I mean, it's all very well to say, well, we owned the whole state, it was ours, we had Aboriginal title, Congress extinguished that title. All right, well, that's where we sit today, 44 million acres. The trick, it seems to me, is to hang on to that 44 million acres, and that appears to be what Native people want to do. They don't want to give it up. So how are they going to hang on to it? Elizabeth Johnson said that she thinks there has to be restrictions on the sale of shares if the corporate mode is going to be the vehicle that is used to keep that land in Native hands. She said there have to be restrictions on the sale of shares. That, it seems to me, diminishes the individual's expectation of benefit. So what's left? And it seems to me that what is left to satisfy that individual's expectation of benefit is what has been proposed, I think, by the AFN and by others, and that is that the individual should be given the opportunity to sell his shares to the corporation. and only the corporation could buy his shares. And I think that in dealing with this subject and with others, we should try to keep in mind a distinction between village and regional corporations, because it seems to me they are vastly different. If in a village you had shares that were, people were allowed to sell their shares back to their village corporation, and half of them did, half of them didn't, so that you had a village where 100 people were no longer shareholders, another 100 had decided to keep their shares, those remaining 100 would then, through that corporation, really be the owners of all ancestral lands in the vicinity of the village. And it seems to me only a question of time before people would begin to say, these others are freeloaders. They're not entitled to use this land for hunting and fishing. And I really think that in the villages, that idea of enabling the corporations to make an offer to their own shareholders to buy back shares is one that people should think very hard about, because you would wind up with what we have in Canada in a slightly different form, status and non-state of status Indians through a series of legislative measures. We have two classes of Indians in Canada. Some are entitled to benefits under treaties, others have lost that right. And some of them lost it by selling out. I won't explain how that occurred, it's just too complicated. But I can see people here heading down that same road. I only have gone through this exercise to show how every time we think we're emerging from the thicket, we find there's some other abyss waiting for us to fall into.